Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it a mistake to place our trust in the wisdom of crowds? Since we take it almost on faith that two heads are better than one, we sometimes fail to question whether widespread consensus actually yields the best possible decisions or the most accurate information. As my guest today has discovered, the process of arriving at collective conclusions is fraught with potential for significant errors, even when everybody involved sincerely wishes to get things right. Cass Sunstein is professor at Harvard Law School and former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. His new book, written with co-author Reed Hastie, is called Wiser: Getting Beyond Groupthink to make Groups Smarter. Cass, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Why do we hold this deep-seated belief that group conclusions are better than those made by individuals?
I think it's three reasons. First, there's a slogan, two heads are better than one, and that slogan kind of sticks in the head. Second, when groups make decisions, we often feel very confident about them. That is that once other people agree with us, then there could be a group of 5 or 10 or 10,000, and we think, hey, we all agree, we must be right. And the third is that some of us have lived experiences in which we've seen individuals going off in not good directions, and the group ends up figuring out what makes best sense.
It turns out there is a big difference between the conclusions reached by what are called statistical groups and deliberating groups. First of all, will you define those two kinds of groups for us?
Yeah, deliberating groups are very familiar. That's everyday life. That's when you work with 5 or 6 people, you all talk to each other, and you deliberate to figure out what's the best thing to do. A statistical group is when you have a bunch of individuals, maybe 10, maybe 12, maybe 100, maybe a million, and you ask each individual what they think, and then you try to figure out what the average or majority view is, and that's the answer of the statistical group.
And they, in fact, tend to reach pretty different conclusions, or they can.
Absolutely. So you can have a statistical group trying to figure out how many products in a certain company are going to sell in the next year, or statistical group trying to figure out which baseball team is going to win the World Series next year. Or you can have a deliberating group doing the same thing, and you're completely right. They'll often come up with radically different answers.
So what is groupthink exactly, and why is it so often invisible to us when we're being affected by it within one of these deliberating groups?
Great. So in a statistical group, you can't have groupthink because people aren't talking to each other. The group isn't exerting pressure. In a deliberating group, what can sometimes happen is that people will think, if other people think something, then my own different view must be wrong, so I'll shut up or I will agree with them. Or you might think, if other people think something, they won't think well of me if I express a contrary view, so I'll just shut up. And what can happen in a deliberating group, and it happens in governments, it happens in companies, it happens in religious organizations, it happens in nonprofits, is that because individuals who actually know something are shutting up in a deliberating group, the group doesn't get the information it needs. And that's groupthink, where the group process leads to the group not knowing as much as its individual members do.
And then there's this thing called happy talk, which emerges within groups that I guess is really good for group cohesion, but isn't necessarily good for ascertaining the best possible information.
Yes. So there's a couple of great data points that in investment clubs in the United States, the ones that do worst are the ones where people know each other well, they socialize, they have meals together, and they have happy talk. They say, I think that's right, let's do that investment. The ones that do best, the investment clubs, they don't socialize, they're not particularly friendly, but they exchange information and there's kind of critical scrutiny. It's also true on corporate boards that the best corporate boards in the U.S. have a lot of contention, disagreement, questioning, not a whole lot of happy talk. So in any group, especially if there's a leader who people really like or who they fear, there's a tendency to say, the current plan is great, and to be enthusiastic and smiling about whatever the leader or the majority thinks. I think that can be devastating to a group success. We have a lot of evidence that that's true, that happy talk can be what maybe is going to make people smile that day or feel really upbeat about what they're doing, but it can't correct possible errors.
A lot of what's in this book really turns on its head what we think we know about effective leadership.
Yes. So I think there's a picture we have that maybe comes from dramatic examples or even movies and television where a great leader has a view, is decisive, comes to the group and says, here's what we're going to do. And then the group executes. If you have a genius at the helm or someone who is all-seeing, that can work. But many of the best leaders in state houses and mayor's offices, in little companies that take off, they do have a good idea. But in terms of so many things that have to be decided, they kind of sit back and they say to themselves, I might be wrong, so I'm going to try to get a great team here of people who feel welcome in their expression of different views. So someone whose politics aren't agreed to by everyone, but he was one of the great in the sense of most important and in many ways successful presidents in our history, that is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He made people think at the early stages that whatever they thought, he was inclined to agree with them. So you'd have different people in the White House thinking he agrees with me, even though they had radically diverging views. And he did that on purpose so as to encourage the full range of options to be developed. And that's kind of a variation on a silent leader, which is often really great at the early stages. It's also good if a leader just expresses confidence in people who are embarking on different paths before it comes to execution time, as a way of making them feel authorized to figure out what they think.
So the idea is that they not only won't be penalized for raising an objection or a concern, but they might, in fact, be rewarded for doing that if it turns out to be something really important.
Completely. So for a leader, a good mantra, and I was blessed to have a leadership position in our government, a mantra I had in my mind is silence is golden. For me, that is, to be quiet and encourage a lot of different views was a way, and always is a way, of trying to stop groupthink from occurring.
How do groups tend to magnify errors over time?
Here's one way it happens. Suppose you have a group that's inclined to believe that a plan can be successfully executed in 6 months, even though it's pretty demanding to get it done in that time. Suppose the individuals tend to think that. And human beings are subject to what's called the planning fallacy. Mm-hmm. I think we all are aware of this, where we're a little too optimistic about how fast it takes to do things. If group members tend to be subject to the planning fallacy, they're too optimistic, then they tend not to correct the fallacy as they talk to one another, but to make it worse. And the reason is that as they talk to each other, each saying, let's say, we can get this done in a hurry, they think, oh, my colleague thinks we can get it done in a hurry. I must be right to think that we can get it done in a hurry. And then the colleague sees the other colleagues doing that. And before too long, people stir each other up so that the group is even more optimistic than the individuals were before they started. That's true about planning, but it can be true about a very wide range of things. For example, how profitable a little company is going to be, or how easy it is to correct a problem that may create serious economic difficulty for a state or for a nation. Group members often, if they start out in a bad direction, they end up in a worse direction just because they are exchanging wrong information with each other.
And belonging to groups of like-minded people has a curious effect on the polarization of opinions. Can you talk about what you learned from groups you put together? Was it Boulder and Colorado Springs?
Yes. So we did a study with a very dramatic result. In Boulder, which is a pretty liberal place, we got groups together of six or so people, about six groups, and we tried to figure out what they thought anonymously. We asked them what they thought secretly about climate change, about same-sex civil unions, and about affirmative action, discrimination to help members of minority groups. And then we had them deliberate after they expressed their anonymous view, come to a verdict in the groups, and then to express their views anonymously again after they'd had the benefit, so to speak, of talking to each other. We did exactly the same thing in Colorado Springs, which is a pretty conservative place, on exactly the same questions. So before people started to talk with each other, just in Boulder with Boulder, just in Colorado Springs with Colorado Springs, the Boulder people and the Colorado Springs people weren't that far apart on the three issues. That is, there was some overlap. Some people in Boulder thought climate change isn't that big a problem. Some people in Colorado Springs said they're kind of worried about climate change. After the Boulder people talked to the Boulder people, they got far more left on all three issues. After the people in Colorado Springs talked to just each other on the three issues, they got far more right on all three issues. And what was pretty dramatic about that was that it was not a very long set of discussions. Just by talking to each other for a matter of 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, you could get the people in Colorado Springs to be kind of living in a different country in terms of their thinking from the people in Boulder. So they could talk to each other, Boulder with Colorado Springs, Colorado Springs with Boulder, before the like-minded discussions happened, not so much after the like-minded discussions. This sometimes goes by the phrase, it's not the loveliest phrase, but the phrase group polarization. And what that means is groups tend to end up in a more extreme position in line with what they tended to think before they started to talk.
Cass Sunstein is with us. He's professor at Harvard Law School and former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. His new book is called Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter. We'll resume the conversation in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Cass Sunstein.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Cass Sunstein. He's a former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, now a professor at Harvard Law School, and author of a new book called Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Cass, we've been talking about happy talk and people kind of encouraging each other to sort of get on board with something that may be a bad idea. Does it turn out are pessimists more likely to be right than optimists?
I would say that. Human beings do tend, about 80% of us, to be unrealistically optimistic, which is probably good because it gives us the enthusiasm to embark on projects rather than thinking, oh, man, it isn't going to work. So realists are most accurate of all by definition. Pessimists are often lowballing their prospects. And in a company, you probably need some. When I was in the White House, I had a staffer who I nicknamed Eeyore after Winnie the Pooh. So he always thought things were going to go wrong. And he is great because he gives other people in government a sense of what they ought to be worrying about. But if everyone was Eeyore, well, America couldn't be America.
Right. So you need someone on your team or a couple of people on your team that can fulfill this role. But it turns out it's not just about being devil's advocate in the same way that debaters are trained to sort of argue both sides of the point. It's better when the person really believes what they're saying to you.
Yeah. So I'd say two different things are important. First is you want people to feel free to voice their doubts and concerns. And you want leaders and other people in positions of authority not to be complacent, but to have at least some level of anxiety. Now, an anxious person isn't always a lot of fun to be around, and you don't want a workplace full of anxious people. But if a leader has some anxiety, that's a tremendous safeguard against mistakes. So that's a key point. I think in a group setting, you don't want people to be despairing or sad, then success isn't likely. But you do want both some anxiety and you want a good mix of people.
How do you open things up so that the person who has a bit of anxiety about a project can talk freely about it, but not sort of open up, you know, depending on your workplace, just like a big old gripe session with people who just sort of aren't very motivated for other reasons?
Yes, there's a great phrase someone now in the White House has, not the president, which is, "Okay, folks, now we've admired the problem. What are we going to do about it?" Mm-hmm. So, someone who is complaining and saying, "Man, oh man, this is not going to work," that's part of admiring the problem, which is something maybe a university can spend a lot of time with. That's what academics are often doing, admiring problems. But if you have to make decisions, if you're in a company or in a school or in a hospital, if you're a doctor, you can't admire the problem. So what you want is people who are thinking some version of, am I admiring the problem or am I offering a course? So a very good idea to have in mind is what's the right path forward, even if that's just stopping a project because it's not good. So if you're a doctor and you're embarking on an operation and the team decides this is actually too risky, then stopping it is the right path forward. Worrying over the downsides and the upsides, the time is limited, as is a patient's period for getting help.
What do we do about this phenomenon that even when we're trying really hard to get things right, the more often we hear a piece of information, accurate or not, the more likely we are to believe it?
Yes, that's also kind of a downside of something that's basically good. Like if you go out on the street and you don't have a watch or a cell phone and you don't know what time it is, you ask a stranger, what time is it? They tell you. You ordinarily expect that they'll be telling you the truth and not
messing
not trying
you.
To confuse you, messing with you. So that's ordinarily what people do. I think with respect to the risk that it's not true, to inculcate in a workplace a sense of both congeniality and collegiality, but also critical thinking, so that at some point in your mind, if you're a leader certainly, but also if you're a colleague, you're thinking, is that exactly right? That if the stakes are high, it's not like a stranger's probably going to tell you the right time. It might be someone sincerely going on a path, but the path or suggesting a bit of information, but it's not quite true. So good workplaces really need that. It's connected with your earlier point about devil's advocates, which is a devil's advocate often is a little bit like an exercise or a show. It's not real. And that's why it sometimes doesn't work. Like if you're in a family and you ask your spouse with respect to something involving a child that you're really both clear on, what's the other side? That can often not be really helpful because it's just kind of checking a box. But if you have someone independent who's it's called red teaming, who's not doing it as an exercise, but doing it for real, trying to figure out a vulnerability in a position, that can make sure, that can increase the possibility that the sincerely held view of one person, credible though it may be, doesn't necessarily prevail because that person might be blind to something.
Is there a particular temperament that makes an individual well-suited to being a red team worker?
I think so. I think the good red team people, and it can be formal, as the U.S. government sometimes uses, and companies and law firms too, or informal, as it sometimes happens in daily life. A red team person is firm, fair, and skeptical. So those are the three defining ingredients. If you have a person who's the functional equivalent of red team, who's trying to figure out how a mayor's office might be doing something that's not right, or a little company might be making a mistake. If the red team person isn't firm, then they won't do their job. If they're not fair, then they'll discredit themselves. So those are three pretty important characteristics.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Beth on the line in Frisco. Hi, Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question today is around the difference between introverts and extroverts in the workplace. I've been in marketing my whole career, and I noticed that people who are extroverts tend to get more than their fair share of the limelight in group discussions. So I was wondering, in a profession like marketing that is so critical to have everyone's voice heard, how do you really encourage everyone to have a chance to speak and make sure that the introverts in the group are being heard?
It's a fantastic question. And there's actually data suggesting that one predictor of whether a group's going to be making a good decision is whether lots of people in the group are talking. So if the group has just two or three people dominating and say it's 10 and the introverts are silencing themselves, that increases the likelihood the group will make a mistake. Now, I think the best way to do this first is for the leader to say, I want to hear from everyone. And if there are people in the room who are introverted, but they have something to say, who aren't talking, actually to ask them, you have a view here? If that doesn't quite work because the extroverts are crowding out the introverts because of their enthusiasm and energy, then what a leader can sometimes do is take the introverts offline and just say one-on-one or by email, do you have anything to add? Didn't hear from you. What do you think? And we had an earlier discussion of the wisdom of crowds, which sometimes works. We can talk a bit more if we like about the specific circumstances. But when it works, it's because you're getting a lot of individuals expressing their own independent judgments. And if extroverts tend to be, you know, a fifth of the group or a third of the group, then you're going to not be hearing from four-fifths or two-thirds. And that that can be a terrible obstacle to good outcomes.
What's the best way to do it when it comes time for a vote? For if this is a somewhat democratic process in an office or you know, with a club or that sort of thing, how can we vote in ways that eliminates as much of the possibility of groupthink as possible?
Well, in our political arena, we have a strategy, which is the secret ballot. And one rationale for the secret ballot is that individual voters don't have to worry, what do my friends and neighbors think? That's a big safeguard against not revealing what you actually believe. So there's real logic in the idea of a secret ballot. Now, one size doesn't fit all. So if you have a little company with, let's say, seven people who are running it, to do a secret ballot might be a little too formal for that company. So you might want to take a poll in a way that clearly says, I want each individual to say what they think. And that can work so long as you have the right culture where people aren't going to take a kind of reputational hit or risk continued employment if they say something inconsistent with what the majority thinks. In many White Houses, what presidents, both Republican and Democratic, have done under difficult circumstances is say to a group of advisors publicly, in the sense of in front of one another, not in front of a TV camera, but publicly, what does each of you think? And then just goes around the room. And so long as the culture is one where people feel quite free to dissent from even what the president thinks or what they think the president thinks, that's a pretty good approach.
Is groupthink a problem for juries?
Absolutely. So I've done some studies involving juries and judges, and here's what we found. If individuals tend to think on a jury that corporate misconduct is bad, and want to both give a punitive damage award, as it's called, and feel outraged by the conduct, they will stir each other up to higher levels of outrage and to higher monetary awards than the individuals supported before they started to talk. In fact, you can have juries sometimes ending up, each individual wants to give an award of, let's say, $50,000, and then the ultimate award that comes in is $1 million.
Wow.
That's possible. And it's because they are stirring each other up through talking with one another. And that is a problem. There's an old movie called 12 Angry Men, mm-hmm. which is as I recall 11 jurors wanted to convict someone, and one, who was Henry Fonda, wanted to declare innocence, and Henry Fonda slowly convinced the 11 that the person was innocent. That's a very unrealistic movie. It's a great movie, but that's not typically what happens. Typically, the risk is that the jury's inclination will get fueled by the majority view. Now, I think our jury system is great, and it's a big safeguard, and all things considered, it works well. But in some contexts, the groupthink problem is real. One thing that can help is if the judge gives clear instructions to the jurors that each one of you matters, and if you have a strong view, don't feel intimidated or cowed. In our judicial system, I've done some work on judicial voting, and we find something that I certainly didn't anticipate, which is if you get three Democratic appointees together on a three-judge panel, the likelihood that each one is going to vote in a liberal direction is super high, much higher than the likelihood that a Democratic appointee will vote in a liberal direction if he or she is sitting with at least one Republican appointee. And it's exactly symmetrical on the Republican side. If you're an environmental group, say, and you want the Environmental Protection Agency to do more to protect the environment, if you're before a panel of three Republican appointees, really, good luck. You're going to have a tough time of it. But if it's two Republican appointees and one Democratic appointee, you've got a much better chance. And what's interesting, I think, about that is that the two Republican appointees on a three-judge panel, they have the authority to decide the case. They're a majority. And the same is true of the two Democratic appointees with one Republican. But there's a strong moderating influence in having just one person of a different, appointed by a different president. And we don't know without looking at the cases to be sure who's right, but there's good reason to think that you can trust a 2R1D panel or a 2D1R panel better than you can trust an RRR or DDD panel.
Cass Sunstein is with us. We're talking about his book, Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Cass Sunstein.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can learn to draw and paint, how to speak French, or plan for your retirement. Courses start each week through spring. Registration and information is at smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Harvard Law Professor Cass Sunstein, a former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, who has a new book out called Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. So, Cass, if groups want to get things right, what can they do to reality check their decisions after they've been made?
Well, after the decision's been made, the best thing to do is to collect data. So if you have, let's say, a federal government that's issuing a regulation designed to make workers safer, and the companies are saying, actually, this is going to have no impact and it's going to cost us a ton of money, and the labor unions, let's say, are saying it's going to have a big impact and it's not going to cost them much money, then the right thing to do is to have continuing monitoring to see if the requirements are helping people or just imposing costs. If you're a company that's marketing a product, to keep very careful track of sales figures. Of course, that's what smart companies do. And to look in real time if technology is available to see if your decision to go that route was a good idea. If you're a police force and you have some new practice that's designed, let's say, to reduce violent crime, you don't want to just do the policy and declare victory. Groupthink may have led to the policy. You want to see as best you can over the next months what's actually happening on the ground.
And then do we still need to be on our guard for the kind of bias that causes us to interpret results depending on what we expected them to look like?
Absolutely. So there's the phenomenon that that people call motivated reasoning, where if you're watching, I happen to be, I confess, a New England Patriots football fan, and in all the games that involve the Patriots, I firmly believe that the referees are biased against the Patriots and Tom Brady is terribly mistreated. And that's motivated reasoning. They're probably biased against the Cowboys. So the truth is that our preferences and values often skew our responses to the facts. What I love about some of the things that technology is now making possible is that you can get pretty neutral or close to neutral accounts of what actually happened in a way that makes your biases and your groupthink going in hard to use to try to fight the figures. So if you have big excitement that some policy involving workers is going to be helpful, and then a year out it turns out that the level of workplace accidents hasn't gone down, you can't fight that, really.
How does the collaborative model of something like Wikipedia play into what you've learned about group conclusions and group decisions?
That one really works, Wikipedia, and the reason is pretty interesting to figure out. One is you have a bunch of people who are involved who are really independent actors. So it's not like they're in a room deliberating with each other, so that a person who has strong convictions or a person who has kind of influence within the firm can lead within the organization can lead them in a wrong direction. So it's really interesting to see if on Wikipedia there's a mob, so to speak, of charged up people who want one of the entries to say that some figure is horrible or some figure is great. There's immediate infusion on the part of other people to try to fix it. Of course, in extreme cases, they have to get more formal with the people who are relatively on top within the organization. But what's interesting is how infrequently that happens. So I think the way to think about Wikipedia is it's a little like a giant crossword puzzle. And crossword puzzles are one area where groups actually do a lot better than individuals. And the reason is when you're doing a crossword puzzle, once the right answer comes in, the rest of the group says, "Oh, that's right." And there isn't fighting over it because it kind of fits. And Wikipedia isn't as straightforward as a crossword puzzle. But if you're having an entry on, say, you know, Hank Aaron, the baseball player, or Roger Staubach, and this, people start putting accounts of their careers, if people put errors in there, it's like a wrong answer to a crossword puzzle will be corrected.
Sometimes groups are looking for an innovative solution and somehow they have hit a dead end. And you write about some organizations that have used things like competitions and tournaments that open the problem up to the outside world. Can you talk about how they work?
Yes. So even if you have terrific people in your organization, and even if your organization is pretty big, chances are that Americans or the world can figure out some things a bit better than you can. Now, of course, not every company can turn it over to Americans or the world, because you need to do it on your own in order to have competitive success. But a tournament inside the company that's opened up to a larger group, or even that's opened up to the world, can often be fantastic in eliciting the information and creativity whoever is out there. So Netflix has an algorithm to say, if you like these movies, you're going to like those movies. If you like these TV shows, you're going to like those TV shows. And they had a big competition to see if there was possibility of improving on their algorithm. And it worked. They found improvements. And they got a lot of really great entries, and one was the best. And what makes this, I think, really exciting is that anyone, even in a large organization, knows that the information and creativity inside a large group is just going to be greater than the information and creativity among a small group, even if the small group is fantastic. One reason the price system works so well in market economies is if shoes have a certain price or soap, it's just incorporating a ton of information about how good the shoes are and how good the soap is. And the question is, how can we enlist the information outside? If you're a government and you want to know if a policy works, it's often a great idea just to propose a policy and to get the public to give its input. You'll get some things that are really basically like boos and cheers, but you're also going to get a lot of information about how to make it better. And this is something companies are increasingly able to do just by asking people, how can we make our product better? And we'll give you some money if you come up with a good idea. One of the things that's been, I think, startling is that you can get a lot of people to participate in these competitions, even if the economic reward isn't that high.
The president last night spoke about the importance of possibly bringing together elected leaders so that we don't see so much division in government. Is there something, do you think that elected lawmakers could learn something from bureaucrats who work in these jobs and are constantly sort of disdained and yet have to come together and work with team members who may not agree with them at all politically, but they have a common project?
I do think so. So the word bureaucrats doesn't get people, you know, really happy. It's not like the group of people who are number one on the most admired list or the people you want to date. I'm dating a bureaucrat. People don't get so excited about that. But what I saw within the federal government, for all its imperfections, is that there are people who are civil servants there who either, you know, you don't know their political affiliation or they don't particularly have any political affiliation. They just want to solve a problem. So there are people in the Department of Agriculture. There are people in the Department of Energy. There are people in the Council of Economic Advisors. You never hear of these people, but they're working their hearts out for the American people, and they're not earning a lot of money, and they know a lot of stuff. And I saw in real time, it was inspiring, that people who, you know, they probably, some of them were Democrats, some of them Republicans, and that didn't matter any more than whether they had blue eyes or brown eyes or whether they were 5'5" or 6'2". What mattered was they saw that a policy is not quite right for a reason that everyone would agree on, or that a policy had great promise for reasons that everyone would agree on, and that would produce a path forward. I was an Obama appointee. I worked very closely with Republicans in the Senate and the House. And I found that if you're trying to solve a problem, often the ideological disagreement on, you know, who you voted for doesn't matter at all. So if a member of the House of Representatives who's, let's say, completely unenthusiastic about President Obama thinks that this policy will concretely on the ground have more costs than benefits, you have to listen to that, and they might be right. And, of course, under President Bush, I know from friends who worked under Bush, that they would find sometimes that the Democrats would raise reasonable points that could be taken on board. And behind closed doors, if you're trying to solve the problem, you can often reach a consensus.
Cass Sunstein is professor at Harvard Law School, former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. His new book is called Wiser, Getting Beyond Groupthink to Make Groups Smarter. Cass, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. A pleasure.